Welcome to this week's edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. Lots of important news covered this week, and we answer the question, what is an apartheid state? Hint, Israel isn't one. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion Podcast, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
I am Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are with us today. Hope you're having a good day, whatever it is. Lorene is sort of getting back. She was on vacation the week before last, and it's been a wild week for you, hasn't it? The week after vacation, you need another vacation, right?
Yeah, you do. And I have to say, Mike, you know, beyond that, just sitting down this week and preparing for the show and just reading through just all the horrible things going on, it's just so saddened. I was like, God, does it ever get any better? Which, by the way, I should just note, because we didn't get to say this last week, but it's the month of Elul. So last weekend was Rosh Chodesh for the month of Elul, which is the last month of the Hebraic year 5781. Rosh Hashanah is less than a month away, September 6th coming up, where we enter into the last month of the year, Tishri, and enter to 5782. Two is a date number. It's the year of year of the house. So I can't wait to get some more of my rabbi's insight on 5782. But this is a month of reflection. It's a month where, you know, Hashem is very near, and it's a month of, you know, where we begin to make teshuvah and prepare for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So for those of you listening, a little bit of Jewish history there, a little bit of Jewish, you know, fact. So,
you know, I have been thinking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as well. And I know the plans at most of the synagogues here in Tampa, or if you're listening someplace else around the country, are to have in-person services. But with the Delta variant, I don't know if everybody's going to go through with that. This really worries me with the Delta variant on COVID. And I wonder if they're making alternative plans at synagogues throughout the country.
I'm not sure. I think they're still planning on, you know, limited seating. My expectations will still have the video, and a lot of people will probably still watch from home this year. But you know, I know Chabad had in-person services last year. They did them outside. People wore masks. They were in open-air tents. And, you know, I think for us this year, we may participate in something like that, because there is something about being there for services.
Yeah, normally, I would agree. Yeah. And last year, and I saw a bunch of online services. Sharzetic is where I belong. You do as well. I was blown away about how beautiful the service was going to be. And I didn't think I possibly could feel an emotional tie to a service I was watching on a computer with either headsets on or pulled. My wife was in the other room watching it, and I thought it was one of the most beautiful services that I have been to there. They did just a fantastic job, but we'll have to keep up on that. We'll talk to some rabbis and report back next week. Let me also say one other thing. You know, we're on our crazy, I don't know what you even call it, WMNF topic where they didn't want us there, even though they broadcast a truly anti-Semitic, anti-Israeli show, in my opinion. And they get public money, one of which is from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And I talked to the attorney in the Inspector General's office this week, who admitted to me that they had other complaints about WMNF, but the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which gives them about $200,000 a year, I think I'm right on that figure, but it's between $100,000 and $200,000 a year, doesn't care about the content. And so I said to this attorney, who was really nice, I said, okay, so if I ran a station that was broadcasting KKK members with tropes about African Americans and all sorts of segregationist views, as long as I complied with their rules about financing, would my station still get a grant? And I was blown away when she said, yep, those are the rules. So what we are going to do, I'm on a mission to get the public funding to stop at WMNF. We're going to turn to Congress And I know, because I covered things for so many years, when there's a congressional inquiry of any agency, it turns their lives upside down. Laureen, you've already talked to Congressman Ted Deutsch from South Florida, who said he would help. But I want to contact all the Jewish members of Congress, plus some of our other local congressmen. And that's ridiculous that public money is being used for radio stations, and they say, we're not going to get involved in the content, whether it's anti-Semitic, anti-African-American, or even anti-Muslim. Yeah, it just should not be public money spent for hate, in my opinion.
Right.
Okay, enough on that.
I should note, I didn't talk to Congressman Deutsch specifically about the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that you just talked about, but we did talk to him about our concerns, because he does lead up the anti-Semitism task force in Congress, and our concerns about the local radio station, which receives public funding, and the treatment of the Jewish community. So certainly, so just want to make sure we're clear on that. But obviously it's an issue that that Mike and I feel strongly about. It's important, because we're a significant Jewish community here, and if it's happening here in our backyard, it can happen anywhere. I should mention, California again. I was surprised, Mike, by this, So those of you may recall, there is this bill that's been going back and forth in the California legislature. It's called a new ethnic studies bill that was that was a requirement for high school graduation, that had so first of all, it didn't consider Jews a minority. It didn't consider anti-Semitism to be an issue. So it talked about all different types of racism and isms, but kept anti-Semitism out of the dialogue. And what was interesting about it also portrayed Jews and Israel in a very negative fashion, and so there's a lot of hoopla around it. They voted against it, they're supposed to renew it, whatever. Now it's coming back up for vote, and apparently people are still very concerned about this, because under the revised language of this bill, it gives deference to the local teachers unions and school districts to decide how they want to teach these ethnic studies courses, which leaves open the question of, can they teach children that Israel is an apartheid state and all these horrific anti-Semitic tropes and things that are just false, especially when you think about the teachers unions, the two largest teachers unions in California that had overwhelmingly voted in favor of anti-Semitic content on the prior version of this bill. And so you had 100 Holocaust survivors this past week wrote a letter to the California lawmakers, asking them, to stand up, especially the Jewish caucus, to stand up and stop this. Like, you can't let this pass. So very concerning that we're still seeing this. I mean, you and I have obviously talked about the teachers unions in this country, whether it's the NEA or the FBA or the teachers unions in California, that they've turned political, and that there's like this very significant bent that is anti-Israel and false narratives.
Absolutely. Well, we hear it all the time that Israel is an apartheid state. That is pure, unadulterated BS. And we have a piece here explaining what an apartheid state really is and how Israel just does not fit that definition. Let's take a listen.
In recent years, some of Israel's more extreme opponents have accused it of establishing an apartheid system in the West Bank. The word apartheid literally means aparthood and refers to an official government policy of discrimination against its citizens based on race or ethnicity. The charge against Israel is false. A comparison to South Africa, whose government administered an official apartheid state from 1948 until 1994, which legally discriminated against its own black citizens. Jewish and Palestinian coexistence is a complex issue. Different perspectives on history, religion, culture, politics, and security need to be taken into account before it can be fully understood. With all these layers, how has propaganda from those looking to delegitimize Israel as an apartheid state become part of the conversation?
If you're going to say that there's apartheid happening in another part of the world, that same emotion of this evil has to be overcome is stirred up amongst a lot of people. And so you say that the Palestinian people are being subjected to the same evils as South Africans, people are going to get very upset and very angry. And unfortunately, the emotions then that the word apartheid evokes, in my opinion, have been effectively, if I can compliment the people, actually have been very effectively used as a smokescreen to hide the truth of what's going on in the West Bank, both with regards to the realities on the ground and actually with regards to the responsibilities that the Palestinian Authority has in relation to the oppression of the Palestinian people.
Apartheid laws made it illegal for blacks to marry, live in the same areas, or conduct business with whites. Black South Africans were barred from certain professions and educational opportunities, could not participate in government, and had to carry documentation. Compare that with the State of Israel, whose 1 million Arab citizens are represented in all branches of government. A government founded on the promise to uphold the full social and political equality of all its citizens, without distinction of race, creed, or sex. For Arabs living in the West Bank, at times Israeli force may be seen as oppressive in context of Israel trying to defend its citizens from terror attacks. But it's a security dynamic that has nothing to do with the definition of apartheid as institutionalized racism. Apartheid's comparison to Israel stems from a difficult reality. Arabs living in some parts of the West Bank are governed by an Israeli military administration and subject to different laws than Israeli citizens. But when you unpack the circumstances surrounding this reality, that's where the comparison ends. Israel's presence in the West Bank is a security measure that started in 1967, after the Six-Day War, when an urgent need for self-defense arose after waves of Arab terrorism from the region created an ongoing existential threat to Israeli citizens. Arab terrorism against Jews had been a reality since 1920, but until the Six-Day War, Jordan's occupation of the West Bank made Israeli security there impossible. After 1967, the scale and frequency of attacks continued to grow. In an attempt to end a Palestinian uprising, known as the First Intifada, the Oslo Accords, a set of agreements made from 1993 to 1995 between Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, gave Palestinian Arabs control over a significant portion of the West Bank under a newly formed Palestinian government, the Palestinian Authority. While there was a renewed hope among Israelis and Arabs that the Accords would usher in a definitive peace process, the negotiations fell apart and instead triggered the deadliest wave of terror Israel had ever seen, known as the Second Intifada in 2000. Faced with incessant terrorism that killed over 1,000 Israelis from 2000 to 2005 alone, Israel's leaders decided to build a barrier wall along the West Bank border, or Green Line, during the Second Intifada that reduced attacks by 84%. Israelis call the barrier a security fence or separation wall, while some Palestinians call it a wall of apartheid. The apartheid label doesn't apply to Israel. Also, because the relationship of Black South Africans to their government was fundamentally different than the relationship Palestinian Arabs have with Israel's government. Blacks in South Africa demanded equal treatment as citizens in their own country. As a result of the Oslo Accords, Palestinians largely govern themselves and vote to elect leaders of the Palestinian Authority government. Israeli laws don't actually apply to much of the West Bank, except for certain areas with greater security risks or higher Jewish populations.
If you look at what's happening in the West Bank, you have areas A, B, and C, a complex arrangement that actually was established not by Israel itself coming down and saying, Palestinian people, this is how we're gonna do things. There was an agreement that came to create this, an agreement between the Palestinian leadership and the Israeli leadership, and also an agreement that was recognized on the international platform. And we know that via the Oslo Accords. And in the Oslo Accords, we have the separation of areas A, B, and C. People oftentimes only talk about area C, which is where you have both the security as well as the administration being done by Israel. They forget about areas A and B, which together comprise 90% of the Palestinian people.
Israel's accusers appropriate the term apartheid in describing these areas, where two separate systems of law, civilian and military, apply differently to Israeli citizens and Palestinian Arabs living side by side.
It's important for us to actually understand why apartheid was instituted in South Africa. And one of the founding reasons was the fact that Black South Africans, we weren't deemed to be as equal as white people from a superiority perspective. So if I am to play with it, when God created South Africans, when God created man, he spent a lot more time with white people than he did with Black people.
As apartheid is defined by racial injustice, its claim on Israel that baffles most Israelis is fed by a misconception that the country is an outpost of white European Jews who support discriminatory policies against an indigenous minority, Arabs. But in fact, more than half of Israel's Jews are from a Middle Eastern and North African background, known as Mizrahim. Coupled with its Arab citizens, Israel's culture and skin color is far more Middle Eastern than European.
So we come back again to the fact that in Israel, that Arabs are part of the government, part of the Supreme Court. That is not apartheid, folks, you know? And the people that push that just make both of our heads spin and should make your head spin as well. And if you hear that, I think you need to stand up and say, no, you don't know what you are talking about. That's just an easy catchphrase to push anti-Semitism. And anybody that says Israel is an apartheid state is anti-Semitic, in my opinion.
In my opinion as well, and they haven't been there, and they don't understand facts on the ground. And, you know, 2 points on that. I mean, you know, obviously the Human Rights Watch organization came out with a report a couple months ago where they accused Israel of being an apartheid state. But when you sort of dig deeper and, you know, peel back the layers, you know, they're sort of talking about, you know, Area A, which is under Palestinian control, where more than 90% of all Palestinians live. Like, it's like Israel has nothing. That is government by the Palestinians, of the Palestinians, for the Palestinians. Israel's not involved in that government. And, you know, which is just so crazy, which, by the way, it also doesn't talk about the fact that Jews are not allowed to live in Palestinian territory. You want to talk about apartheid state, it's actually the reverse. Like in the West Bank and in Gaza, Jews are prohibited. And what's very interesting about that under the Palestinian Authority, it is considered a crime against the state. It's considered treason if you try to sell property to a Jew. So for instance, in Hebron, there's a father and son who, you know, sold a house to a Jew. The father and son were both murdered. They're both killed by the Palestinian Authority leadership. So this is, you know, this happens regularly. There's actually signs if you are in Judea or Samaria, you're about to cross over into Palestinian authority territory, there are actually signs that say Jews prohibited, like no Jews, like you can't go in there. Like there's literally signs. I've seen them with my own eyeballs that say this. Like, so, you know, it's just people don't talk about this. And what's also interesting is like Area C, which is the area, which is sort of like this vast empty territory that's controlled by Israel according to the Oslo Accords, and it's really sort of a security buffer. You know, what people don't talk about when they talk about settlements and things, a lot of these, you know, quote-unquote settlements occur in Area C, but what people don't talk about, because they're always talking about, the Jews, they're all in Area C settlements, blah, 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 all these things going on, all these, you know, radical settlers. Well, what you don't talk about, and I thought it was really interesting, there's an article in the World Israel News this past week about Palestinian settlements in Area C. You never hear about this on the media. There are countless illegal Palestinian settlements that are funded by NGOs out of Europe, all over Area C.
And NGOs are for the acronyms for people who don't know, non-governmental organizations. And so they're not sponsored by the government, although sometimes under the table they seem to be. But that's what NGOs are, and they're very active in the anti-Semitic world.
Very. And so there's these NGOs that are funding, and it's been going on for over a decade. These huge villages are like communities that are popping up, and you never, ever hear about the Palestinian settlers. You never hear about that. So just, you know, something to keep in mind, but also talk about NGOs. I mean, I thought I was very happy to see this week that France, that President Macron said that France will not be participating in the historic Durban conference in South Africa, which, you know, again, this is like the birth of, you know, anti-Semitism at a global level at the UN, when during the Intifada, which Mike and I talked about last week, during the Intifada in the early 2000s in Israel, when, you know, women and children were being blown up and murdered in school buses, pizzerias, and everywhere else, you know, just everywhere on the streets. You know, there was this conference of all these Jew haters who showed up in Durban, and they're like, Zionism is racism, and Israel is an apartheid state. And, you know, this is right after Oslo, after Israel's like, we will land for peace, we'll do whatever you want, we want peace, we want peace. Israel made all these concessions, and what did they get in return? They got an Intifada. They, you know, just like, what did they get in return for, in 2005 when the small Jewish community that lived over in Gaza withdrew? Like, the military, the IDF actually went and took them forcibly from their homes and said, no, you can't live here anymore. You know, we got terrorism, we got Hamas, we got, you know, rockets being launched into Israel regularly. I mean, this is real. And so, very happy that that France will not be participating, as well as the UK. But I have not seen any news yet about Canada.
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, Canada and France have had a lot of anti-Semitic acts. But I've got to say, Macron has been really terrific. It's sort of a dichotomy between where some of the anti-Semitism comes through in France. But Macron, the president, has been very supportive of the Jewish community. We've got to give him his props on that. But there has been a lot of anti-Semitism in France, and a lot of anti-Semitism in the United States. You know, you talked about blowing up kids and all of that. There is a bad anniversary coming up, actually two bad anniversaries, coming up on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. But also in Israel, there is the 20th anniversary of the pizza bombings at the Sapporo Pizza, where a bunch of people were killed, 130 people were injured, kids were killed by terrorist attacks, and it's just another day of infamy again for Israel because of that.
Right. Yeah, so 15 people were killed, 7 were children, 130 people were injured. What's amazing about this is that the woman who was the mastermind behind this terrorist bombing, her name is Tamimi. She is Alam Tamimi. She is a Jordanian national who lives in Jordan, and the families of some of these victims have been trying to seek her extradition to America for quite some time.
And she was in prison. She was given 16 life sentences in Israel, and then was let go in a prisoner swap.
Yeah, in a prisoner exchange swap. Israel always lets them go in prisoner exchange swaps. It was to get, I think we got like one soldier back in exchange for all these terrorists that we let go. But she, just so we're clear, she is actually living, you know, quite a nice lifestyle. She is a very well-known media personality. She hosts a talk show on the Hamas-affiliated Al-Quds TV network. And she's also a regular analyst, get this, not just on Al Jazeera, but also on BBC Arabic. So I think, you know, she's getting paid for this. So I something to be, you know, keeping in mind that, like, somehow these large media outlets have now normalized this woman who literally has the blood of all these people on her hands. And, you know, and of course, under the pay for slave policy, which is the actual governing law in the Palestinian Authority, and, you know, they pay families of terrorists. So to date, of those terrorists and their families, the Palestinian Authority has paid those families, we believe, close to $1.2 million. I mean, that's just so sad when you think about that.
It is outrageous.
130.
But the reason that the United States or people in the United States are seeking the government to get extradition is because two Americans were killed in the bombing at the Sapporo Pizza. So they're trying to get extradition. I would not hold my breath for that. One thing good that happened this week, the Bahrainian minister met with Jewish governmental folks to talk about the number one problem in the Middle East, and that's Iran. And I think that every country in the Middle East, whether it's Israel or the Arab countries, are scared to death of Iran.
It's such an open aggressor. I mean, it literally has no boundaries. It has no fear of aggression, and it's caused, we've talked about this before, I mean, literally tens of thousands of Muslims have been murdered and brutally, you know, just terrorized and slaughtered by these organizations,
including
that are supported
the
by
president who is the butcher of Tahrir Rehman. He's the newly elected president who was a judge and sentenced these people to death. I am concerned that we are taking steps toward war with Iran, and war, nobody wins in wars. It is really bad. It's really scary. And Iran has a huge, huge army. Fortunately, the Israeli army, which is smaller, is better trained, better equipped to handle Iran. But it would be bloody on either side. But I thought what would be interesting is if we could see a comparison between the Iranian army and the Israeli army and understand just what is at stake here. So here's that.
This comes amid the backdrop of the US, the UK, Israel, and EU all highlighting intelligence, which they say shows that Iran was behind the recent attack on commercial shipping. The attack killed two European nationals. In addition, an emboldened Hezbollah, which is supported by Iran, has fired more than a dozen rockets at Israel in recent days, which has not been seen since Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon in 2006. And Iran is accused of repeatedly launching missiles at targets in Saudi Arabia and at US military bases in Iraq. At the same time, the West has been trying to coax Iran back to the stalled negotiations over the nuclear deal in an attempt to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. With the new ultra-conservative Iranian president Ibrahim Raisi now sworn in, it is uncertain whether Iran will return to negotiations or invite other action, such as further sanctions or military pressures, to limit its nuclear program. There is concern that tensions could escalate into an overt war between two of West Asia's strongest militaries, Israel and Iran. So just how powerful are the two militaries? Iran has 525,000 active troops compared to Israel's 170,000. Iran's paramilitary forces number more than 1 million, while Israel has only a few thousand. Iran also has more tanks and armored vehicles, a larger navy, and more access to fuel. However, Israel has a larger air force and a strong defense industry, as well as access to US and European suppliers, and so has a qualitative advantage in terms of its technology. Israel has allies on its side, the US, UAE, Bahrain, and even the likes of Saudi Arabia, which is also extremely wary of Iran. However, Iran has proxies in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, so any conflict is likely to extend across the region. For this reason, we may see a continuation of the covert war that has been taking place to limit Iran's influence in the region and ability to obtain nuclear arms. In the meantime, an EU official has suggested that the negotiations on the nuclear deal are likely to resume in early September. This is Jody Cohen from Herzliya, Israel.
Like I say, I don't know what will happen if they're, I mean, Iran is determined to destroy Israel, but the other Arab countries are scared of Iran as well.
Well, look, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that many of the Iranian people, you know, probably half the population, do not support the supreme leader in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. I mean, and I think in many ways, you know, they're, you know, the Mossad is very active in Iran in trying to thwart their nuclear system. You know, I have no doubt that there are many Iranian nationals who are involved in that, because Jews have been part of Persia for literally thousands of years. I mean, that goes back to the times of Esther and Mordechai. And, you know, I mean, you just think of all this stuff that's going on there. I mean, it just makes no sense. And I do applaud the Bahraini senior official openly meeting with the IDF commander. I mean, but for the Abraham Accords, that wouldn't have happened. I mean, I think the other thing that happened this week that was super exciting news regarding Morocco, for those of you who recall, Morocco also joined the Abraham Accords late last year. And so what's so exciting about this is Yair Lapid visited Morocco. And it's really the first time that you had it, I think, an Israeli official go and openly meet with the Moroccan government since the Second Intifada in the early 2000s. So they are very excited about working together. There's multiple agreements were signed between the two countries during the visit with Yair Lapid. And I think many of us, you know, there's such a rich culture in Morocco, and Jews are very much a part of that culture, because just like Iran and Persia, Jews have been in Morocco for thousands of years, and very much part of that very rich culture, as well as the culture that also helped shape Spain. So between the Moroccan and the Spanish Jews, you know, working and that coexisted and lived with their Muslim Arab, you know, neighbors, you know, and as well as the indigenous people of Morocco for thousands of years. So I just applaud. Those were two really positive stories this week. I also had to mention this because the Human Rights Watch, I mean, you know, it's like a sort of small story, but they at least admitted it.
Yeah.
admitted that Gaza, that Hamas violated the laws of war amounting to
war crimes. They're saying war crimes. Woo-hoo! for their launching of rockets into Israel and killing Israelis and killing Palestinians as well.
Right, exactly, for launching rockets specifically into civilian populations, as well as their misfired rockets, which killed people in Gaza. So, you know, it's a small little story. I was happy that Human Rights Watch actually said something about that, because they pretty much almost always turn a blind eye to Hamas and what they're doing. So, you know, I thought that was at least a
they are
step
not
for them.
What you would call Israeli friendly. That's for sure. Hey, let's do this. We got to take a break, and then we're going to come back with an amazing story about the Holocaust and survival that I think you're really going to enjoy. This is the Third Opinion Podcast.
Third Opinion will be right back. I want to encourage you to visit our webpage, thirdopinionpodcast.com. There you can leave us a comment or make a suggestion, and you can also listen to Third Opinions you may have missed. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to the Third Opinion Podcast, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorraine Jaffe.
We have a story here that just is, to me, a story of hope, a story of horror. It's about a Holocaust survivor. And the story comes from a young woman who competed in a contest for Nova Southeast University. She's in the 10th grade at Osceola School in Pinellas County. And she did a mini documentary with a Holocaust survivor. And it's just a tremendous piece that we want to play. The young lady is the daughter of Craig Patrick from Fox 13, who, in my opinion, is probably the finest reporter in the Tampa Bay area. He's their political guru. We worked together at Channel 10 years ago, and then he got out of the business for a little while. I think he even ran for office when he's back at 13 doing politics. He is just a tremendous reporter. Clearly, the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree. And she, for this contest, found a Holocaust survivor who had been at many of the camps and put together this piece. And then we will talk to Elizabeth Patrick right afterwards.
I was always a very happy person.
Helen Borenstein is caring, generous, and wise, and a guiding light in how to live a good and long life. But her stories of surviving the Holocaust will break your heart.
My mother was a guest in Treblinka, and my father was thrown from the quarry to his death.
She will never forget the moment her mom said goodbye.
And she said to me, Hallelujah. She called me Hallelujah. I don't think we ever gonna see her again.
She would see her again, but only in dreams.
And she said, Hallelujah, I came to say goodbye to you. And I never gonna forget, never. I see them in my dream quite often.
Helen was a figure skater in Poland before the Nazi invasion, before they took her away, to the death camps that killed 6 million Jews.
What kept you going?
It was a miracle.
A miracle that involved others who rescued her over and over again.
And I was maybe 16 feet from the gate.
From the savior who pulled her out of line on the march to the chamber.
He pulled me out and we didn't know that the group was the first transport to Treblinka, to chambers, gas chambers.
To the savior who saved her from a Nazi who had flown into a rage.
And put a gun to my head. My girlfriend who worked in his office saved my life.
To her transfer to Auschwitz. And the savior who helped her escape the march to death yet again.
I was standing in front of a very tall friend of mine. And the couple was looking for me and my sister. And she hid us. And after this, they sent us to Bergen-Belsen.
That camp had no gas chamber, but Helen said they also had little or no food. The guards massacred through starvation and disease.
I was lucky. Somebody, she worked in a kitchen. She said, come over and I'll give you food. 3 times a day, I had food. And I fed my sister and another girl from Canada.
That's the first lesson I learned from Helen. Compassion and kindness and courage can bring light to our world in ways we may never know. It already has, from people we never knew.
She never told her children anything about it, but her daughter came to me when I live in New Jersey, and I told her how she saved 3 souls.
The movie Schindler's List showed how one man saved lives. Helen's story showed how there were many others who answered the call, sharing food though they were starving themselves, putting their own lives at greater risk to save others. It inspires me to give more, to match hostility with kindness and hatred with love.
We should accept everybody.
But while we defeated the Third Reich, the evil that fueled it still remains, and we have to stand up to it. That's the second lesson I learned from Helen. She said a lot of people overlooked Hitler's bigotry and lies until it was too late.
Many Jewish people voted for Hitler because Germany lost the World War I.
Hitler seduced with promises of greatness, exploited people's biases with conspiracy theories and racist propaganda, and it took off from there.
You are not the same color, you are not the same religion, you look different, you this, that.
Now the same hatred and dark impulses that fueled Hitler's reign of terror are making a comeback.
Jews will not replace us!
We saw it in the neo-Nazis who marched on Charlottesville. We saw it on the deadly invasion of our nation's capital.
People who have such a freedom and such a good country became copy of Hitler.
It's why we always have to speak out against bigotry and injustice. And it's why we have to show love and respect.
We born the same and we die the same. We have to get along and live like one nation. No discrimination.
Lessons from a call I'll keep in my heart.
You're welcome, Elizabeth. Have a good day.
So tell me how you came up with this interview for this project. It's a beautiful piece, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much. So I've been wanting to do a documentary about the Holocaust for a very long time. And for the Holocaust Remembrance Day, they had a list of a few of survivors that would be willing to talk to us about their experiences. And I chose Helen Borenstein as the person who I wanted to interview because she survived Treblinka, Auschwitz, and Bergen-Belsen. And it struck me how she could stay such a caring and positive person. So I really wanted to talk to her and learn from her wisdom and strength of surviving the Holocaust.
It was an amazing story. I mean, when she talked about the people who helped her, so many people actually kept her alive. It was sort of a miracle when you think about it.
Yes, sir.
So, I mean, she was saved several times at all the camps by people who cared for her, from the woman who gave her food in the kitchen to the one who kept the Nazi from shooting her. How did she explain that things went so well for her?
She explained how kindness and compassion can bring light to our world and how spreading kindness to one another and how it's so important to spread kindness to one another and speak up against violence and hate. In the documentary that I made called Helen Borenstein Saviors, she explained how people's acts of kindness saved her over and over again in her experiences in the death camps.
What made you so interested in the Holocaust?
It is undeniably the most heartbreaking event in human history. And I feel like everyone has the obligation and responsibility to learn about it to make sure that it never repeats itself again.
You know, there is a rise of anti-Semitism in the United States. I saw toward the end of the documentary how you sort of linked things to what happened in World War II and what's going on in the United States now. Tell me how you feel about that.
The same hatred that fueled Hitler's rule over 80 years ago is still very prevalent and alive today. You see it in the neo-Nazis, in the Charlottesville March, and the invasion of the Capitol. You see people today chanting the same anti-Semitic phrases that they did 80 years ago. It may seem like the Holocaust could never happen again, but there are still people who deny it and wish to continue it. That's why I feel like if you don't speak out against hatred and prejudice, history will repeat itself. And that's why I feel like everyone has a responsibility to learn and educate themselves about the Holocaust and speak up and stand up against hatred.
You know, a lot of people who aren't, you're not Jewish, right?
No, sir.
Yeah, okay. I am, obviously, because we do a Jewish radio program. Do you think people at your age realize what went on then and what's going on now? Particularly those who aren't Jewish. Jewish kids learn about the Holocaust, I think, for the most part. But non-Jewish kids, your peers, your friends.
I would really hope so. I think that it's so important to study the Holocaust to make sure it never happens again. And I think that it's so important to stay informed with news today. And I really hope that students should be able to speak up and stand up against hatred.
Did you show your documentary to any of your friends?
Yes, sir.
And what did they say?
They were very touched and impressed by it.
Do you want to do this, following your dad's footsteps, be a journalist?
Yes, sir, definitely.
Well, you're on a good road. I mean, you put this together really nicely. Did your dad teach you how to do this? Or it's something you just picked
sir.
Up? I had a feeling maybe he had a little bit, but you wrote it, you edited it, and put it all together, right?
Yes, sir. My dad helped me with it a lot, too. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, he's a terrific reporter, probably the best in Tampa Bay right now, I think. Did in talking to her, did it change your life?
Yes, sir, definitely. When she started telling her stories, it was so heartbreaking, and I felt like crying. And I feel like it really shows the responsibility that everyone has to study the Holocaust and make sure that no one has to endure what Ms. Helen Borenstein survived and what 6 million Jewish people who died in the Holocaust had to endure.
What about the people that hate so much today, like the people you showed in the Charlottesville March or in the insurrection in the Capitol? What do you think is driving them?
I've never met someone hateful who is racist or prejudiced, but I know that they exist, and we see it in the news. We see it so often. And it's a really big problem. Yes, sir.
So to people who see this thing that your dad posted on Facebook, and he's obviously very proud of you and rightfully should be, what would you like people to come away with who see your piece?
I would make sure that the Holocaust never repeats itself, to make sure that history would never repeat itself, so that we can study history and stand up to injustice and hate and prejudice, or that history never repeats itself.
You know, Jewish people worry about that all the time, and I've had some friends that have said to me, who are not Jewish, it could never happen here. You're crazy. You're paranoid. It could not possibly happen here, but it could.
That's what happened with the March on the Capitol, and that's how it may seem so far off, like the Holocaust could never happen again. But if you do not stand up to hatred, and violence, things like the March on the Capitol could escalate very quickly. With all the hatred and division in the world today, the Holocaust could very well repeat itself.
Well, Elizabeth, I am so thrilled to talk to you. You did such a beautiful, beautiful job.
Thank you so much. It
deserved the award.
I wanted to add on the Capitol, when we were talking about that, how it's crazy to me how people could dismiss it, because I feel that it was very well planned.
You should be proud, and I know you're going to be a superstar, okay?
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Take care. Bye-bye. So I just was blown away by that, and the kindness that was put forth in the camps, and her desire as a non-Jew to tell this story. A very impressive young woman who told me that she wants to go to the University of Florida study journalism.
Yeah.
I pushed the University of Missouri. Her dad's not going to like that. So out of state tuition, but that's my alma mater, and it was a great journalism school. I'm sure I'll hear from Craig. He's a great guy, as I say. I think he's the finest reporter in the Tampa Bay area. If you don't see his stuff, check him out on Channel 13, because he's right on point all the time. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. I guess, you know, the Holocaust hangs over the head of every Jew. Don't you think, Lorene?
Well, I do. And you know, we're going to have to talk about Poland.
Oh, man. Yeah, let's talk about Poland and reparations. That's just terrible.
Right. So this week, I mean, this has been, you know, there's been some dialogue about this going on for some time within the Polish parliament. But the Polish parliament has now approved legislation pretty much dismissing any restitution claims for Holocaust survivors. This was just voted on this past week. So the law rules out any appeals against legal decisions made outside of this 30-year deadline. So the legislation amends the Polish Code of Administration Procedure to dismiss outstanding claims that are more than 30 years old for the restitution of property seized during the periods of the Nazi and communist rule. So, you know, when you think about the largest Jewish population in Europe lived in Poland, the largest Jewish population impacted by the Holocaust was the Polish Jewish community. And there are still so many families that have these outstanding claims of restitution. I mean, actual, you know, land, property, personal property, artwork, jewelry, whatever it is, like these things have been stolen from them, taken from them in horrific conditions. And the Polish government just said, we've had enough. We don't want to deal with your claims anymore. Retire the Jews complaining and wanting our property, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So this was a really, really disappointing. I think the entire Jewish world is sort of in shock, actually.
Yeah, I just can't understand that. I'll tell you another thing that I'm disappointed with. Now, as you well know, and I've said it here, I'm a big Joe Biden supporter. I think that, you know, I like Joe. But I think he made a misstep in appointing Sharon Kleinbaum. She is an ultra, ultra liberal rabbi who supports BDS, who has mourned the killing of some Hamas people. And she was appointed to a liaison position for the government. And I can't understand that. at all. But, you know, here's the deal. I think that it's healthy to criticize the people you like. That when they misstep, you can't say everything they did was wonderful. And I think that Biden made a huge misstep that one there. I don't understand how you can appoint a liaison or how you can be a rabbi supporting BDS. That doesn't make any sense for me. And the other one I want to mention real quickly is Mario Cuomo. That was his dad, Andrew Cuomo, this week, who's stepping down, who I liked. I thought he did a great job during the COVID crisis. He needed to go. And the great news is that the new incoming governor, Kathy Hochul, is really tied into the Jewish community. She's been traveling the state as lieutenant governor, doesn't see Cuomo very often, says they're not close, and she's gone to Jewish day schools, to synagogues. She has a really strong relationship with the Jewish community. You know, obviously it's very big in New York, so I'm glad that she's going to be in there, and I'm also glad that Cuomo, someone who I liked, but he needed to go. That was just terrible, terrible stuff. So, you know, even when people you like do bad things, we've got to point it out, I think.
Right, you know, I mean, look, I think also for New York, okay, so, I mean, one of the reasons why I'm excited about Hochul is because New York has been sort of less than reactive to all the anti-Semitic attacks. You know, in many ways, New York has been ground zero for a lot of the violent physical attacks against Jews that have been growing in a rising number in the last several years. And so Hochul, who has been very connected to the Jewish community, I'm super excited about this. I really hope it has a direct impact on the state's response to the rising tide of anti-Semitism there. But, you know, we should also talk about, the ADL is about to hold a forum on anti-Semitism. And we talked about Myers Leonard. He is
People make mistakes and maybe learn. Yeah, the NBA basketball player who played with the Miami Heat, who made some really anti-Semitic remarks, has all of a sudden.
But he learned his lesson.
Right.
You know, it was interesting. I mean, he was, and it was interesting because he used the Kiker and did some things when he was playing video games. Didn't really understand what he was saying. And what I appreciated about him is he was immediately repentant and apologetic and then actually took action. And that's how you could tell, like, he has been speaking at Jewish events and, you know, really wanting to make amends and make a difference and educate people, even in the NBA, who are completely clueless about anti-Semitism. And so he's going to be speaking at an ADL event coming up this week on anti-Semitism as an anti-Semitism education forum. So I just wanted to applaud him for that.
Absolutely.
I think that's a big step. So I really appreciate him, doing that. And China, I just want to say, you know, I've just had, China has been like a red flag since I was a child. I've always thought, like, China, they're so dangerous. They're so evil. They're such horrific human rights violators. And, you know, China, you know, got this week, you know, the Chinese run news media, because everything's run by the government, the communist government in China. It had this despicable, like, cartoon of Blinken, because Blinken had met with the head of the World Health Organization to talk about COVID. And they have, you know, Blinken with this large Jewish nose and the devil horns coming out of his head.
It's wrapped in an American flag,
I mean, you know, this was just so, you know, and this comes from China, and, like, demonizing Blinken and the Secretary of State of the United States of America, who is a Jew, you know, who, by the way, we didn't mention it, I think, on last week's show, but, you know, but there was actually at Blinken's office in the U.S. Capitol on, I think it was on an elevator door, there were swastikas.
Literally,
in the same building he works, you know, there was somebody that was, like, that was doing that, and that, you know, this should be like, wait a second, this is the United States of America. He's our Secretary of State. This should not be happening. And, you know, and it was also uncovered by FireEye, which is a cybersecurity company, that the Chinese government has been carrying out massive cyber attacks on Israel, Saudi Arabia, Iran, et cetera. I mean, China is such a bad actor. This didn't surprise me, but it's just, you know, they're, you know, you just never know what they're going to be up to. So, but I'm just really, I was just really disgusted, disappointed by it all.
Yeah, I agree. But before we run out of time,
you have a positive story. You got a good story, Mike.
Yeah, I do. Here is we're gonna go out on a happy note. The Barbara Streisand is a grandmother, and she is felling about being a grandmother. Yes. And can you can you imagine her with her grandson or granddaughter, I can't remember which, singing lullaby songs with Barbara Streisand's beauty? Have you ever seen her in person? Oh, she's wonderful.
No, I've never seen her perform.
Oh, I saw her at Amalie Arena last year, 2 years ago. She did the whole show, took a break, you know, came back out and, you know, schmoozed with everybody. But she's a grandma and says it's the greatest moment of her life. And yes, as a grandfather myself, being a grandparent is the best thing in the world. So, Babs. Congratulations. I want to hear your lullaby songs. Maybe she'll come out with a lullaby album or something like that. But that's our happy
amazing
story to end it. But you hear that music? That's not Barbara Streisand music. That is our music. And it means we're out of time. Thank you for being with us. Tell your friends. You can get us on wherever you get your podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. This is The Third Opinion. I am Mike Deason.
I am Maureen Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast this week. Remember to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.